Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And I am the conscience of psychiatry. Today's show is pre-recorded, so I decided what would I really like to do today. I thought about a few guests, and then I thought about something that came up at the start of my last show, which was about helping older people. And at that time, I confessed to being 76 years old, and I talked some about my life. And it occurs to me that it may be worthwhile for some folks for me to talk about what I think the good life involves. So this is a show somewhat about my own life, but mostly about the kinds of principles, the kinds of ideas and meanings I've gotten out of these 76 years. I want to start with some of my earliest memories. I remember being very little. I was sitting down and looking at a carton that was much bigger than me. And I remember looking at the lettering on the carton and thinking, someday I want to find out what's in those letters, what that's about, what reading that stuff is about. I remember in kindergarten, first grade, our principal in those days was allowed to read from the Bible at the weekly time when all of us kids got together, the assembly, I think we called it. And he would stand up and front of all of us. He seemed like an older gentleman to me, as I remember back to him. Kind of slender, serious looking. And he'd be behind a big oak podium, and he'd have a huge Bible in front of him. And he would slowly turn maybe one page and read from it. I can still kind of hear those pages turning. I don't remember anything he ever read to us in those early years of my life, but I remember that solemn experience of finding something important in a book. When I was older, in high school, I sometimes had an experience which one could see as spiritual, one could see as other things, I suppose. It's got a psychological term for it, a hypnagogic images. Before I would go to sleep, I would lie awake, getting ready to go to sleep, and the room would get a golden glow, and I would be transported, and I would be reading from a great book. And in that book, I would be finding great meanings. Now, I'm probably 15 years old, 14 years old at the time, and I think this went on in the early years of college. Once in a while, this would happen. And I would read that book. I'd be getting the meaning, and I'd awaken and then realize, oh, I'm just nodding off, going to sleep. It was very vivid and very golden. I even learned to get back into what I used to think of as the great book or the golden book experience. But I never got that great meaning that I was looking for in that experience. So why do I start with this? I'm not sure. Other than to tell you that life is about importance. It is about meaning. It's not just about being pain-free. It's not just about getting rid of bad feelings or difficult emotions. And it's not just about having lots of pleasures. I don't even think it's necessarily about happiness. I think life starts the good life. The good life that I've seen my friends and family have, the good lives I've seen my clients have, my patients, and my own life. These good lives, these satisfying lives, not necessarily the happiest lives, and I'll try to deal with that along the way today, but these lives are about meaning. They're about finding the truth about how to live well, properly, in the best way. Now, going back to when I was a child, I didn't know much about love. I didn't come from what you would call a loving environment. I kind of was on my own a great deal of the time. And I thought a lot about what was going on around me. I did a lot of thinking. And I decided that childhood wasn't a very good experience. And I thought that was probably a general principle. You see, when we're children, life is what we've got. Life is what we've got when we're children. We think that life is what we're experiencing it. We don't imagine there's something greater out there or different out there or more fulfilling out there or even maybe not even less fulfilling out there. So I decided that life wasn't fair to children in particular. And then I would spend my time growing up, when I grew up, telling people about life being unfair to children. But typical of kids, especially who have very bleak childhoods, who don't have a lot of love in it, I had a lot of other things starting at age 12, a lot of accomplishment, huge amount of accomplishment starting about age 12, but not a lot of happy times, family times. In particular, mostly just with friends, occasionally a teacher. So I decided that I was going to report how childhood was not very fair, was unjust, and I'd work on fixing childhood for children. But amnesia set in, as I started to say, as it does when childhood is pretty bleak, and I didn't remember childhood very much at all until my 30s. But I did remember the principle that childhood was unfair and I was going to try to do something about it. Now, I know from many of the people I deal with as a therapist that I'm not alone in having had to think through childhood and its meaning. Some of the people I know with the most horrendously abusive childhoods, many of them decided early on that they would never mistreat anyone. They made moral decisions as early as they can remember, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, making a moral decision that they were not going to be treating folks the way they were treated. Again, even for the child, life is about meaning. So one of the secrets to life is to look at the meanings you've created for yourself, because you made these meanings. Your parents may have taught you one thing, but you surely, surely passed it through your own rational, moral filter and came to your own conclusions about it. You may have heard a minister saying things that you thought were unreasonable. My wife, Ginger, when she was quite young, was going to Sunday school, and the Sunday school's teacher, who had a lot of authority, I think he was also the family doctor in town, if I remember correctly, said that once you'd heard Jesus' name, even if you were in some other non-Christian civilization, if you heard Jesus' name and didn't accept him, you would go to hell. But she thought that was so unreasonable and so unfair as a child that for quite a while, she gave up on religion and even on, to some extent, on spirituality. So children evaluate. Some children decide that they're going to get even. Very bad kind of meaning to assign your life. Some people decide they're never going to take any, I'm thinking of an expletive, they're not going to take any nonsense from other people, and they're going to fight back the moment they're threatened. Many people decide they're not going to dare care about anybody because of the losses and abuses in childhood. So really, really important is the meaning you give to your childhood and then, and hence to your adulthood until you've re-examined it and decided what's really important here. Now, one of the meanings I decided early on was that love was not really something to be tried for. That's when I had to correct. And I had to figure all that out for myself pretty much. Because what I've come to in the long run of life, the 76 years, is that we live by meaning, that the meaning are contained in the principles that we live by, that's a big part of the meaning, the principles we live by, and that a huge chunk, if not the heart of it all, is about love. It's about justice. That was my first concept way before love. It's about leading a good and just life. And as a part of that, or in addition to that, or even above all of that, it's about love and relationship. Now, what is love? I've mentioned this in passing in some of my shows. Love, I've concluded, and I'm sure there's many ways to look at this, love, I've concluded, as a working proposition, least practical principle, love is joyful awareness. So if you're joyfully aware of a sunset, you love that experience, you love the sunset. If you're joyfully aware of little creatures running around in your backyard, the chipmunks, the squirrels, the rabbits, that's love. If you know another person and thinking of them as well as seeing them and being with them makes you happy and joyful so that you light up at the very idea of them, at the awareness of them. See, I use that word awareness because I think it fits. Then you have love for that person, joyful awareness. You can have joyful awareness of your work, of nature, of God. I do believe that the most fortunate people not only feel joyful awareness over human beings and nature, but at the idea of a creator, a force beyond us, something larger than us, not necessarily a little old man in the sky, which I think, in fact, is a belittling description of religion because I don't really know any religious people who believe that particularly. Most spiritual people and most religious people believe there's something greater than us that endows meaning to this world and infuses the world with love, with the capacity for us to be joyfully aware. And if you can find a way, if you can get past your scientific viewpoint, past your injuries that you've had from your religious upbringing, if you can get past your cynicism, if you can get past all those things and open your heart to having a joyful awareness of that which is greater than us, that which is beyond us, or call it God or not, you're going to have a lot better life. Guaranteed. One of the few guarantees I'll give you on this show about lessons from 76 years. I myself decided God wasn't a rational idea when I was in my teens and was one of the three class agnostics in the 1950s. There were three of us, which was quite remarkable. There probably wasn't one in many schools. We were real intellectuals, and we poo-pooed God. I even made girls cry on occasion, which I now feel really bad about, undermining their belief in God. But I got to feel that there was a meaning in my life, even a moving in my life of another presence that helped guide me in my work. And eventually, despite my just messing up again and again and again in my love life, finally, almost out of mercy, made me aware of Ginger and Ginger aware of me. And those of you who know me realize that was about 28 years ago that we actually got together. So I spent a long time going in and out of darkness on the issues of love in terms of romantic love and my own life. And that's what someone is faced with who doesn't have much exposure to love as a child. You got to figure it out. And if you don't figure it out, you got to hope God intervenes and just said, look, stop avoiding. Here she is. So I believe that there's some things in our lives that are beyond us. I do believe that there's a presence in our lives beyond us. It's a comfort to me, but it also gives me some understanding of how things turn out. So I believe that life, we should approach life as a meaningful experience, that things happen for a reason, and that there's an underlying meaning, even though we will spend our whole lives pondering it and often wondering about it. I believe that the most successful lives, the most fulfilling lives, are based on principles. And I believe that justice is one of those, that we want to see a world in which there's as much justice as possible, that will contribute to it in our ways. And those ways can be any expression of enhancing life. And I believe that there is love in this world, that it infuses this world, that we, when we experience it, we actually feel joyful awareness. As I began to get more spiritual in my 30s, before Ginger, I realized that it was best to think of myself as a being, not just as a brain or a material object, not just as a sophisticated animal or a higher animal, not just as the product of the best activities of my frontal lobes, but to think of something more. When I would look into the eyes of someone I loved, when I'd be sitting with my patients, I'd be caring and looking at them. I didn't think, hey, you got great biochemical balances going on behind those eyes. I didn't think, wow, what great genetics and molecules you got. I felt like I was looking at someone beyond all that. As the Quakers say, I now believe I was looking at that of God in each of us. And I loved my work as a result of this. I loved working with my clients or my patients as a result of this. You know, because of the limits that we place on therapy, I was able to experience closer relationships with my clients than I might have been ready for at times in other places in my life. At least more reasonable and sane relationships than I was ready for elsewhere. And I realized that on a bleak moment, the world would kind of be gray and white, black and white, like an old movie. But that if I remembered that I had something of God in me and that the world was essentially a spiritual experience, that color returned. I would literally perceive the world in a more beautiful fashion. Now, I believe every human being is capable of these experiences. I think they're really the simplest kinds of experiences. I think that many, if not most, people have them. We don't often talk about them. And certainly a scientist like me, a psychiatrist like me, doesn't often talk about them. But they're very basic. I'm not doing anything very elaborate here. I'm telling you sort of the rock-bottom experiences that I have that have made life really worthwhile. Now, if you're going to live by ideals, principles like justice and honesty, living as just and honest a life as you can, and as loving a life as you can, it doesn't happen easily. It's an odd thing. It's really difficult to do that. It's really difficult. It takes courage. On the one hand, it takes courage because as you try to explore loving, being in loving relationships and really caring about other people, you will feel betrayed at times. You will feel rejected, abandoned, hurt at times. You will feel used at times, manipulated at times, or you may just have an unfortunate, horrific, traumatic loss of someone you love and have deep mourning. Now, love itself is beautiful and happy. Love is the happiest of all experiences. It's joyful awareness of something deeply spiritual and wonderful in our lives. Joyful awareness. But because human life is frail and people are unpredictable and we betray each other and hurt each other, and we all do that at some time or another, life is tough and requires courage. So love is no panacea. It's not Pollyannish. It's, I think, the most important aspect of life, but it can be the hardest at times. But once you've decided that you're going to love no matter what, that you're going to have unconditional love, once you've decided that, then you get a certain amount of sense of security, because you know no matter what happens to you, you're not going to stop being a loving human being. That's like one of the most basic principles of life. Once you've decided that no matter how you get battered, no matter how chance or human design harms you, you're going to believe that love is inherent, that it's your deepest, most personal, best experience. Your being joyfully aware and caring and treasuring of another human being. Because along with joyful awareness comes treasuring, wanting to take care of, wanting to be there for, even if what you cherish is not a human being, but a garden or artwork or a project of some kind, or your ability to do something like play music and music, you're going to treasure it, protect it, advance it, enhance it. So once you've decided that whatever you love and your ability to love comes above outrageous fortune, then you've got a rock. And if you can attach it as well to a greater meaning in life, you have a very firm rock. Now, in order to love, you have to be brave. You also have to be tough. Because if you are unable to take care of yourself, to say, I have to protect my own basic interests, you won't be strong enough to dare to love. As long as you feel overwhelmingly vulnerable or feel victimized or feel injured or walk around feeling betrayed, regardless of whether you've been betrayed, we all get betrayed. As long as you walk around thinking that way, as long as you feel like, you know, life can't be lived, or you don't have the strength, you won't be able to love. because it takes a lot of strength to love. And that's not only because you're going to get wrapped around a flagpole by relationship, not by love, but by relationship, but also because you're going to be hurt at times by loved ones, or hurt at times by pretend loved ones. And furthermore, and this is maybe the biggest, you're going to have to protect loved ones. So I've noticed that men and women who don't grow up with a sense of their own strength and the need to protect themselves, when their kids or their husbands or wives get in trouble, they'll have trouble protecting them. They may feel a certain amount of love for them. They may feel a certain amount of commitment for them, but they can't feel full-blown love because that requires they defend and protect. So if you're a person who has trouble standing up for your husband or wife or your children or your friends or your colleagues, if that's the case, you're going to have trouble loving and having the deepest relationships you can have. In one of my earlier books, I described it as having a cocked fist with one arm and hand and an open hand with the other. You have to be prepared to be able to defend yourself in order to be strong enough to love and certainly strong enough to reach out and to try to contribute to justice in the world. Am I making sense? Wish I could see your faces like I usually do when I'm giving a talk like this. I'm hoping you're out there thinking, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. I'm going along with this. Can't wait to hear what he's going to say after the break. I'm going out on a limb with this particular discussion today. Maybe you could sense that. I'm kind of really telling you what I think life is about. I think it's part of what I owe as somebody who's reached 76 and actually feels that he's lived life reasonably well, and most importantly, lived life better in general from year to year with ups and downs. Ups and downs, but basically lived life better from year to year. When I come back from the break, I want to address things like when bad things happen to good people, when misfortune strikes, when illness strikes. But I want to emphasize that these principles, that life is meaning, that life has to be lived by principles, that these include justice and honesty, and that love is the spiritual glue that makes the whole thing work, makes it worth it. Makes the whole thing worth it. If you keep that in mind, that the other things I'm going to be talking about as we go to break and come back from break, that they just can be properly handled.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. Welcome back to me sharing with you some of what I've learned these 76 years. And I took you all the way back to age 2 or 3. It's an interesting experience for me to do this, not working from any notes. I kind of have set in front of me something I wrote a while ago called Principles of Life, 17 Principles of Life. It's at the end of my book, Medication Madness. But I'm not as yet turning to them. So let me kind of recapitulate, because this is not an information show. It's a thinking all around the meaning of life. So I think from early on as children, we try to get some meaning out of our lives. We're the meaningful animal, or the animal that lives by meaning, in a sense, not quite an animal. And maybe isn't an animal at all on some level. And the meanings we get out of that childhood, wow, they guide us for the rest of our lives. So they need reexamination and rethinking. And that is a part of this meaningful life. We need principles like honesty and justice. And that the whole thing makes sense if we're aware of ourselves as sources of love. There is a piece of advice I really want to give you based on these 76 years. Become a source of love. Now, of course, you are already. Well, become even more a source of love. And I say that to myself as well. I have to tell myself that all the time. Become a source of love. Be a source of love. Nothing is so overwhelming in my experience, which is now long, plentiful, and wide, that being a source of love is the single most important meaning in life. And if I think of the heroes that I have, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Jesus, Moses, and a lot of other folks, all of them talked about love as the center. Love for God and love for other human beings. So this is not new. I'm not saying a single new thing today. When I was a young man, I thought lots of new things. I didn't know that the basic principles had already been laid out. That, in fact, if I had, as I've done in more recent years, studied the founders of this great nation and their wives, that I would have saved myself a lot of trouble and found out these very basic principles. Now, freedom is extremely important. It's not the highest value, as I once thought, as libertarians teach, because freedom without love is an empty, empty box, and it is a box. You sit in it by yourself. But freedom is what allows us the maximum choice and the maximum capacity to love as human beings. So I believe that one of the things that we should support, believe in, and seek for ourselves is as much freedom as we can. But freedom is the freedom to choose. It is not anarchy. It is not freedom from relationship. It is not freedom from duty and obligations. It's the freedom to make choices, hopefully good ones. Our founders were so aware that freedom without a moral foundation would not last even. And you won't keep your own freedom without a moral foundation. Now, if you look at life in these terms, you might find it helpful to ask yourself, what's my last resort? What is your last resort? It is amazing the wide variety of last resorts, by which I mean where you turn when the wolves are at the door is breaking in, you're all by yourself, whatever your idea is of last resort and worst place to be. Your friends have turned on you. You have a dreadful disease for which there is no cure. Where do you turn? You've gone bankrupt. You see no way out. you've committed some dreadful crime for which there's no forgiveness. I see a lot of folks like that in my medical legal work. People who, in my case, usually people under the influence of psychiatric drugs. Sometimes it turns out as I evaluate the case, it isn't psychiatric drugs. People who have done something that's so bad that they think there's no forgiveness. What do you do? What's your last resort? Well, my profession of psychiatry has a very clear answer. Your last resort is to imagine it was caused by your aberrant biochemistry or your genetic makeup or both, and you should take psychiatric medications. In fact, first you should accept the diagnosis, and then you should take psychiatric medications. And for millions and millions of Americans, that's their last resort. It's a terrible last resort. It's disempowering. It's godless. It's spiritless. It's materialistic. It's treating yourself like a broken machine. And it doesn't work. Hardly ever, if ever, have I met someone who turned to any drug, alcohol, smoking tons of cigarettes, marijuana, Prozac, Xanax. Have I met anyone who has turned to psychoactive substances as their last resort who has anything but a very dulled and often despairing life, a limited life? You are best equipped with your, I'm hesitating because it's either God-given or evolution-given, or in my case, I believe given by both. I believe, like the founders, this world was designed in a meaningful way, and evolution to me is a part of that meaningful way, that design. It may not be everything. I'm not going to get into that anymore today. I think there are some things about evolution that aren't accounted for, don't account for everything. But I do believe that choosing drugs and diagnoses for your last resort, the thing you'll turn to, is a huge mistake. So I think, for example, when a man or woman is in mourning for the love of their life, giving them a drug suggests that the drug in this tough time is the last resort. Not God, not their own inherent abilities to thrive, recover and thrive, live with the loss, even if it's felt as it probably will be for the lifetime. Friendship, family, good works. Instead of thinking of those as the last resort, when you give the pill to the person in deep grief, you tell them that's the last resort. And it becomes the last resort because an effective psychiatric medication, one that's strong enough to be working, will be dulling your capacity to experience love. Your frontal lobes are impaired by every psychoactive substances you take. That's what makes them psychoactive. They're impairing your frontal lobes. And your frontal lobes are the seat of your capacity to love, to plan, to think, to choose. Above else, the first thing that goes is spirituality, that fine-tuning of love and caring and empathy. Empathy, empathy for others. The heart of life. That empathy for others. And even empathy for oneself. Because one of the things we need to do as a part of overcoming our childhood experiences often is to have empathy for that child. To understand what that child went through in a caring way. Not easy for a lot of people who feel guilty and don't want to go through that experience. That's an aside. So I think that taking a psychiatric medication is no more a good last resort than banging your head against the wall. Another way to distract yourself and ultimately reduce your fine-tuning. The best life is lived finely tuned. The best life is lived finely tuned. That means learning to handle horrible pain, the desire to kill yourself, horribly violent feelings, whatever it is you struggle with, despair. You're best going to handle that and move on to a loving, forgiving, grateful life by having your fine tuning, your fine spiritual tuning. As a part of that fine tuning, I recommend daily experiences of gratitude. Daily experiences of gratitude. Be grateful for being alive. That's the rock bottom. That's one of your good last resorts. Be grateful to be alive. Now, being grateful to God is one of the very best last resorts. Being able to say, whatever meaning in life there is, whomever, whatever, infuses us with the capacity to love and infuses life with meaning, I am grateful to you, even if I know my life is now shortened, even if I know that I have some suffering ahead, I am grateful to you for this existence. It is impossible to be loving and crazy. It is impossible to be grateful and crazy. Craziness, including the extreme of psychosis, is given up on what I'm talking about. Craziness, what we call psychosis or insanity, is giving up on what I'm talking about today, on believing in yourself as a source of love, believing that there's a source of love greater than us, believing that we've been given the fine-tuning we need to, in our brains to make a good life, but we have to work hard at it and have the courage. All of these things are the opposite of craziness. And to help somebody come back from craziness or to help yourself come back from craziness, this is the root. So you can't solve problems by taking psychoactive substances. In fact, you can't solve life with a shortcut. You can't solve it by gambling and getting a high. You can't solve it by being rageful inside yourself and feeling high and mighty and judgmental and moralistic and being an angry person. You can't have a happy life by seeking pleasure, believe it or not. You can't have a happy life through sexual pleasure, food pleasure, activity pleasure. Even work pleasure by itself will not bring you a happy life, even good work pleasure. The happy life, I believe, can't even be reached by seeking happiness. In fact, I can't even tell you that there is a foolproof route to happiness. It's foolish to think there is. So much of it is out of our hands. But I do think after 76 years that I have a pretty good idea, at least a good enough idea to share about how you maximize your ability to have a satisfying and potentially happy life. Keep coming back to yourself as a source of love. Seek loving relationships. Seek to make the words and that come out of your mouth and the actions of your body. Seek to make that enhancing of a loving attitude toward life. But always remember, you must protect yourself and your loved ones in this process, or you'll give up, you'll be so badly hurt along the way, you will quit. Now, I chose early on a way of life that involved actively participating in the world to try to increase what I saw as justice and a better life. You heard that at the beginning of the show, that it went back to being a small child, deciding that life was unfair to children, and I was going to remember that. Do something about that, and specifically tell people about that. And of course, it was, though I hadn't put it together, it was in part connected with books and writing from early on. And many of you know that in college I really found the direction for myself when I was invited by a friend to go to a state mental hospital and volunteer, and found in that hospital a meaningful way to spend most of my college days, hours, and early on realized that what the most injured human beings need, and even wrote about it as a college student, what the most important thing that injured human beings need was love, support, caring. In addition, of course, to protection from injury, which was a dual theme of the work that we did as volunteers. Now, not many people choose to take on, as I have, literally perhaps the biggest 2-3 companies in the world, at times the federal government, my own psychiatric association, to go to court, to write, to speak about these things. That has been terrifying at times. Terrifying. At times felt overwhelming. And until Ginger came into my life, or was brought into my life, and I brought into hers, incredibly lonely, incredibly lonely. To be on the cutting edge like that is incredibly lonely. But looking back on it now, while it's not what I would recommend, thus far, as far as I know, not a single person that's been in my practice as a patient or client has taken on that life, so I'm certainly not been pushing it on anybody. My children, as far as I can tell, have not really lived like that, aren't living that kind of life, where you're not sure about your very safety in public, as it was for many years. I don't think about it or worry about that anymore. But I can tell you, having done it, and Ginger, she was here with me. We're actually apart for a couple of weeks. She's down helping our daughter and son-in-law with our second grandchild. She would tell you that it's incredibly worthwhile to do this and to live this way. And of course, my heroes from early childhood have always lived this way. Can't tell you why that's so. But literally my heroes from at least high school were living these kinds of lives. So I'm not even sure this is the happiest life. But I do know that if you choose to live this way, and you're allowed to live, whether or not you are very successful, measuring success is hard and success is out of our hands, you will have an incredible sense of having lived a worthwhile life. So I can tell you that at 76. It's been worth it. And Ginger, not at quite 76 yet, 60, 61, she'll tell you it's been a great life. And if you're blessed enough to, at some point, get a good partner, in this case with Ginger, a partner that exceeded all imaginings and expectations. I mean, like from another world, especially given how I was brought up. then you will feel very, very blessed. Now, what about the folks who do get horribly injured along the way? They get killed. Or they're interrupted by some disease or misfortune. I don't have an answer for that, other than this. That once you are living the life you believe in, you will feel that life has been worthwhile, even if it's for a minute. I tell this to my patients, that as much suffering as they're having, as much as they feel failed and futile, the moment that they have a sense that this day has been worthwhile, there will be no more regrets. I can't explain that to you. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But it's true that once you sense that you, Jim, Jane, George, Janet, in my case, Peter and Ginger, the moment you get a sense that you're in touch with being a source of love, that you're strong, sufficiently strong, none of us are strong enough, but sufficiently strong to be a source of love, to stand up for yourself and your loved ones and what you believe in, you will feel life is worth living and you will have no regret. It's a fact of life. Go there. Find that place for yourself. It may be so different from mine. Oh, what did I say? Maybe so different from mine? It will be. It will absolutely be different from mine. It will be different from Ginger's. I guarantee it. It might not even remotely resemble our meaning, what we've found. But I believe it will begin with being a source of love and trusting that. I really believe that. And I believe if you believe that and you act on that, you will then come to think, you will think that there's a greater meaning in life that love is connected to, that it's not just about you, not just about your loved one, that it's a greater meaning. Most people who love, whatever they love, become spiritual. They become convinced that there's more to life than all this other junk and all the terrible stuff. So, go there. Go to being a source of love. Take responsibility for being a source of love. Believe there are first principles of life to live by. Believe in justice and honesty. And whatever you do, whether you are the best carpenter or handyman, whether you are the best artist that you can be, I don't mean the best in comparison to others, the best that you can be, whether you are devoting your life to raising wonderful children and being a good wife, whether you're devoting your life to supporting in a traditional way a family and being the best husband and father you can be. Whatever it is you find as an expression of you, as your source of love, whatever you find that you want to protect and treasure, nurture, and develop, whatever it is that you find, that moment, and every moment you're in touch with it, you will feel in all your fiber that life has been worth living and is worth living in that moment, and that the rest, however bad it has been at times, even at the threshold of suicide or violence, however bad it's been, or even in psychosis, however it's been in the past, that it's all been worthwhile because here you are finally at age 25 or 35 or 45 or 55 or 65 or 75 or 85. Finally, you are there. that's my last thought. I wish all of you well. I have really enjoyed talking with my audience about these issues. It's about as heartfelt as I can get about them. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.